Session number 10640, Major Archibald Jack, part one.
Could you tell me, first of all, how you came to be involved with SOE and Yugoslavia?
Well, it so happened that in the beginning of 43, I arrived in the Middle East and became an instructor in mountain warfare at the mountain warfare school at Tripoli in Syria. And this was not too far off Haifa, where there was an SOE school, and I got to know the people there, and so I then thought it would be interesting to see whether there was a vacancy in some SOE operation, and I was offered this job of going in as sabotage officer with the Mihailovich mission, which was going to go in September, and thus it did. We dropped in the normal way, but unfortunately we lost the moon, and we had to drop in absolute darkness, and the planes didn't like flying too low in those mountains, so we went out pretty high. I went out at about 2,000 feet, something like that.
When did you drop in?
It was in September, 43. And
whereabouts was it?
Well, it was near Čačak in Serbia.
How do you spell Čačak?
C-A-C-A-K.
Now, I think you were going to give a kind of chronological background to the situation there.
I think it's wise to do this, because the time factor is an important issue historically in this particular story. Let us start in December 41. Already at that time, Mihailovich was regarded by the Germans as as an important enemy, and there were posters offering rewards for his capture being displayed throughout Serbia. And I've got the full text here if you'd like to see it. And then Mihailovich has been accused of being a traitor alongside Nedić, who was commanding the Home Guard, General Nedić. But it's worth recording, I think, that in 42, Mihailovich actually signaled to the Yugoslav government in London requesting that Nedić be included on the official list of traitors. And this was later broadcast by the BBC, so there's absolutely no doubt those accusations against Mihailovich are completely false. As to the opinions the Germans had of Mihailovich at that time, in July 42, Himmler sent a signal to Heinrich Müller, who was his representative in the field, saying, quote, "The basis of every success in Serbia and in the entire southeast of Europe lies in the annihilation of Mihailovich," unquote. I think that's important. In the report which the SS chief of police sent in August 42 to Hitler, and he had been sent by Hitler to repress the Serb resistance, he mentions Mihailovich and Nedić, but there is no mention of the partisans whatsoever. So as far as the Germans were concerned, the partisans did not exist in Serbia in August 42. Now, this is an important thing. In November 42, the BBC broadcast a message from the Yugoslav Prime Minister telling Mihailovich to reserve his forces and energy for the future. He's been criticized so often for not being active enough. And here he is getting direct orders from the Yugoslav Prime Minister to lay low, because he had been already too active. I mention this because these were the instructions which were issued by and large to all the resistance movements in Europe, that they were to await a date, and on that particular date, which would coincide with an Allied landing or something like that, they were to come out, but by no means were they to come out in advance. And Mihailovich was being pushed all the time to do more and more and more, whereas his attitude formed on this message from the Yugoslav government was to reserve his forces for the day of the landing, and then there would be the Ustanak, which in Yugoslav means the uprising. And this was all organized and all planned, and at that time the whole of the Nedićevci, the Home Guard, which was fully armed, would have come over to him. And that was not the slightest doubt. And in fact he did in the end declare the Ustanak when the Russian invasion came. Because he then realized that the British invasion, the Allied invasion, which he'd always been led to believe would take place and was never going to take place, he was completely deceived on that score, would in fact never take place. Now, in January 43, Keeble, who was running the SOE office in Cairo, had access to enemy intercepted signals. Whether they were Enigma, I doubt, but I don't know what they were. And Davidson and Deakin in the office assembled the information and produced a secret wall map. And with this wall map, Keeble was convinced that the partisans should be backed. That was the beginning of the switch in the SOE hierarchy from Mihailovich to the left, to the communist. And in justifying the switch to Tito, SOE claimed that he was holding down 24 German divisions, whereas in 1943 the German troop strength in Yugoslavia never exceeded 8 under strength divisions. So it's just to give you an idea of the fact that all the claims made by Tito were accepted by SOE as the truth.
Why should Deakin have been involved in such a thing, do you think?
I've got no reason to tell you that I have an answer to that question. He just happened to be working in the SOE office at that time, who was entrusted by Keeble and with the aid of Davidson to produce this map.
Because one would have thought that somebody like Deakin could have no sympathy with communism.
I think that at that time Deakin was just assembling on the wall map the information that was coming in from intelligence sources. And then on the 30th of January, this is very important, of 43, with Deakin's personal help, Keeble hands Churchill, who happened to be in Cairo, a memorandum on the partisans. And it was because of Deakin's having worked with Churchill on his Life of Marlborough and that sort of thing before the war, that there was this contact, and Keeble was able to see Churchill personally. And in fact, SOE in London was furious about Churchill being wedded into the Tito concept, and the Foreign Office also was disturbed. But Churchill personally gave Keeble orders in January 43 to go ahead with full partisan support. Now, what was happening on the German side, what was the German opinion of Mihailovich at that time? Because I've told you what it was earlier. On the 9th of February, General Galen, who was the head of German military intelligence in Eastern Europe, reports, quote, "Amongst various resistance movements, the movement of General Mihailovich remains in the first place with regard to leadership, armament, organization, and activity." And at the end of February, Hitler writes to Mussolini, quote, "Your Second Army should regard Mihailovich and his movement as uncompromising enemies of the Axis powers," unquote. And at that time, Ribbentrop calls for Mihailovich to be captured and hanged. And this is the man who was being accused very shortly afterwards of being a traitor and a collaborator. But funny things were happening in the SOE office. At about that time, Davidson, in his book, recalls the fact that Keeble pushed Klugman, who I haven't mentioned yet, who was working in SOE, into a lavatory, saying that security was after him, but he promised nevertheless to protect him, which was curious. Klugman, as you know, was a communist from Cambridge days. He was part of the Cambridge communist clique, and he was already a Russian secret agent and a recruiter. We know all that now. We, of course, had no idea at that time. Now, this is an interesting fact which came out after the war, and no one had the slightest knowledge of it at the time. On the 13th of March, 43, a meeting took place at Tito's request between three partisan leaders, Gilas, Velibit, and Popovich, who were very important figures, and General Diepold, the German General Diepold. The partisan delegation stressed that the partisans saw no reason for fighting the German army, but wished solely to fight the Chetniks, that means Mihailovich's troops, and that they would fight the British should the latter land in Yugoslavia. That was a pledge to the Germans on behalf of Tito by these very important people. Gilas was later vice president, you know, and so on. And this only came out when the German papers were later. Furthermore, they proposed a cessation of hostilities between Germans and partisans, and Velibit and Gilas were flown in German planes from Sarajevo to Zagreb for further discussions. It wasn't just a discussion in a cornfield outside Sarajevo or anything like that. But Ribbentrop, for some reason, forbids all further contact with the partisans. Now, by that time, we had Bailey in, He went on Christmas Day of 42, as far as I remember, to Mihailovich. Marco Hudson had been in there since 41, but Bailey was senior to him and went in to head the mission to Mihailovich. And he received a message on the 28th of May, 43, from SOE for Mihailovich, and it was claimed in the message to be a direct message from the commander-in-chief, and in it it said that Mihailovich's forces were quite useless, and then, quote, the partisans represent a good and effective fighting force in all parts, and only the Quislings represent General Mihailovich, unquote. It also ordered Mihailovich to withdraw his forces into a very small box inside Serbia. Now, who drafted this signal? It's never, ever been traced, and no one's ever been looked into the question.
What are your own beliefs?
I have absolutely no idea, but Bailey claimed that it was Davidson who did it. There was a catastrophic reaction from Mihailovich, as you can imagine. The Foreign Office was absolutely furious, and they called for the signal to be rescinded. And I have no idea whether it was or not, but I think probably not. Now, in June, is this interesting, do you think?
Right. Mm-hmm.
In June 43, McLean arrives in Cairo seeking an appointment of interest through his friend Leeper, who was the ambassador there, and thus Orme Sergeant of the Foreign Office. His name comes to Churchill, who requests his return to UK for personal briefing. Not having yet heard of the partisans, McLean believes he's being sent into the Chetniks, but it wasn't quite like that, because we now know that he was going to be sent in as a political officer to a Tito mission headed by another brigadier. But then there was this bizarre history of the fake signal which landed on Churchill's desk, purporting to come from the commander-in-chief of the Middle East, claiming that McLean had a record of being a pronounced drunkard, had shown signs of cowardice in battle, and was also a well-known homosexual, and therefore unfitted for the post that he had in mind for him. Churchill showed this signal to McLean, and McLean, of course, couldn't account for it, and Churchill said, well, don't worry about that, we shall ignore it completely, and so McLean returned to Cairo, and there he met the commander-in-chief, who had with him a Colonel Vellicott from intelligence, who said that he had been ordered by SOE Cairo to spread these rumours about McLean in order to prevent his getting this appointment. McLean then went to the SOE office, where he saw Keble, and Keble was furious to see McLean wearing brigadier's badges of rank, and told him that on no account would he be leading a mission into Tito, and that all the files and signals were closed to him.
Do we know who was responsible for spreading these rumours?
I've never heard any explanation. This report, of course, is confirmed by McLean himself. As a result of this, when McLean went into Yugoslavia, he insisted on having a direct line of communication with the commander-in-chief and also with Churchill. He wasn't trusting SOE any further. Now, Mihailovich was already complaining to the Yugoslav government about grossly untrue BBC reports. All sorts of operations carried out by his forces were being attributed to the partisans, and he was being accused also of collaboration. At this particular time, it's interesting that Ambassador Rendell, who was our ambassador to the Yugoslav government in exile, is quoted as saying, quote, many of the BBC speakers, such as Latuper and Petrovic, are violently leftist. So it's not surprising. The BBC then reported in July that Novo Vreme, which was the paper, newspaper in Yugoslavia, carried a large advertisement in which Germans offered 100,000 gold marks for Tito's head, omitting completely to say that this advertisement offered the same sum for Mihailovich's. And I have photocopies of this advertisement, and there's absolutely no doubt that the BBC just cut out any reference of this sort to Mihailovich. In August 43, the Enigma signals, left no doubt that at least at the highest level the Germans remained set on Mihailovich's destruction. And that's Hinsley speaking, who is the expert on the Enigma signal. The 8th of September, of course, Italy surrenders, and Mihailovich felt certain that there would be an invasion which would follow, which, of course, never took place. On the 9th of September, Douglas Howard of the Foreign Office writes a minute, quote, "I am sure that SOE Cairo, plus the Minister of State, do not want us to come to a satisfactory agreement with Mihailovich." That was the Foreign Office view in London of what was going on in Cairo. On the 12th of September, this was following the Italian surrender, 1,500 Royalist troops assaulted Priapoli, killing 200 Germans. Bailey was present. And on the same day, the Royalists took the surrender of a large Italian garrison at Priboi after an all-night fight, and Hudson and Mansfield were both present and witnessed that. On the 14th of September, the BBC report that the partisans had fought these battles, not the Jetniks, although the signal had gone back from Bailey and so on, that they had done it. And then, this was very important, on the 14th of September, on SOE instructions, Bailey negotiates with the Venezia division, it's the Italian division that had surrendered at Berene, that they should agree to pass under Allied command, thus retaining their arms. SOE had, although the Royalists were so short of arms, and the whole point of the Italian surrender, as far as Mihailovich was concerned, was it was the first opportunity that he was ever going to get, and maybe the last, to get the arms they so much required, SOE sent a signal to Bailey saying that the arms were not to be handed over, and that the Italians were to surrender and retain their arms. But what followed was interesting. On the 13th of October, the BBC then announced that the partisans had taken Berene, which in fact they had, but they had taken it from the Chetniks. They had driven the Chetniks off. And directly they had driven the Chetniks off, they then disarmed the Venezia division. And so the partisans lost, gained from the Chetniks, this huge amount of arms, which was much more than Mihailovich received on the whole of the war. And this was on SOE instructions. And of course Mihailovich explodes with indignation, and it's not surprising. McLean drops to the partisans on the 17th of September, and Armstrong, Brigadier Armstrong, drops to Mihailovich on the 24th of September, and I dropped about the same date. And with him was Seitz, who was the head of the Americans' sort of submission. He was a colonel. And Armstrong carried a personal letter for Mihailovich from the Commander-in-Chief, dated the 8th of September, which was full of extravagant praise, saying what a marvellous person he was and how much he was doing, and continued, quote, "I hope that the effective assistance we are now in a position to offer you will contribute to the liberation of your country from the yoke of German tyranny," unquote. I only mention this because by the next month it was the last sortie that we had. On the 29th of September, the Chetniks, when I say Chetniks, they're the Royalists, they blow up four railway bridges at Mokragora, having killed 100 Bulgars, all in the presence of Armstrong, Hudson, and myself. In fact, I blew the bridges. I was responsible for blowing them. On the 5th of October, and this was very important, a huge body of 2,500 Royalists captured Visegrad, which was a German garrison town, killing 200 Germans. And we then went off to the south to where the railway bridge crosses in a gorge, the River Drina. And there is a railway bridge which was 150 metres long. And we drove there was a German garrison in pillboxes holding the bridge. We drove them off. They got off in an armoured train which came and picked them up. And we then blew up the bridge. And I think I've got some photographs of it here. As far as I know, it's the biggest bridge that was blown in southeastern Europe during the war. 150 metres single span is quite a big bridge. In spite of the signals, after both these operations, the Mokragora with the four bridges and the important bridge of Visegrad sent by Armstrong back to Cairo, the BBC attributed both these operations to the partisans. So Mihailovich naturally realised that he was being betrayed. And the situation got very difficult between him and Armstrong after that, because obviously Mihailovich didn't trust us anymore, and rightly so.
Could I ask you at this point to what extent you felt in danger because of what the British government's policy towards Mihailovich? Did you feel in personal danger?
Well, we retained a very friendly relationship with the Yugoslavs that we were working with, not only with the officers who were commanding the corpses and brigades and that sort of thing, also with Mihailovic's staff, Lalatovic, and who's the head of operations, and the intelligence officer. They were absolutely charming, couldn't have been nicer, very quiet, controlled people. But also with the orderlies we had, who were very, very faithful servants and would do everything they could for us. I don't think we felt that anything of that sort was likely. We didn't feel worried at all.
Does it surprise you that no action was taken by Mihailovic against British agents?
Well, I think as the situation got worse and worse, and it became increasingly obvious that as the Allied armies moved up Italy, that an invasion of the Balkans became less and less likely, if you understand what I mean, that Mihailovic felt that he was being abandoned.
Did the Chetniks ever come to you with complaints about the British government's policy?
Oh, consistently, they would say, we can't understand. Of course, they used to listen to the Yugoslav BBC news, you see, and quite often when we were on the march or something like that, we wouldn't hear it, and so we would be asked, what on earth did that mean, and so on, and we would just have to say, I'm very sorry, we don't understand it ourselves. But haven't you reported back that we did it? Yes, we did. We did report back that you did it, that we all did it together, and we can't account for it. And we used to send these signals back to Cairo saying, what on earth's happening, and will you please publish on the BBC reports reattributions and apologies and that sort of thing. But this was never, never, never done.
But you didn't suffer from any personal antagonism?
No, 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 no. And I think that is an enormous compliment to pay to the Serbs. And then a Foreign Office memorandum, dated most secret sources, in November 43, and this has come out of the documents, of course, reports that at the end of November, quote, Mihailovic has given orders to all Chetnik units to cooperate loyally with the Germans. Now, can you imagine anything more ridiculous? Here were all our submissions scattered over Serbia, and they knew exactly what their Serbian loyalist troops were doing. And there was never any conception of this happening. And in view of the operations we just carried out and the Germans we just killed the same month at Visegrad, can you possibly account for that signal from most secret sources? It must be a fake. So what was the organization inside most secret sources which is producing fake information?
What are your own speculations?
I've absolutely not the slightest idea. On the 26th of October, Eric Greenwood and Jasper Rutum carried out an operation on the Iron Gates and the Danube, they actually opened fire on a tug, and they blocked the Iron Gates for not very long, but nevertheless, that resulted in 150 hostages being shot. And there's no doubt about that. Both Jasper Rutum and Eric, they saw the advertisements going up. They were put up in all the railway stations, things like that. You see, I've got some here, and I will show you some of them, which I used to tear down when I saw them, because they were so bad for morale. And then the 18th of November, with Mihailovic's approval, Armstrong sends at SOE a most important signal of 92 parts, which I remember helping to encipher, with a proposed solution for the whole of the Yugoslav problem, delineating areas for royalists and partisans. And it was addressed to London for reference, quote, to the highest level, which must mean the Foreign Secretary and the War Cabinet. I've got the whole text of the thing here. And it was a very, very sensible concept, and it was one which, if it had been applied, would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives. And it's one which could be applied today, in which it would divide, as we were talking about it the other day, the previous sort of Austro-Hungarian Empire on one side and the previous Turkish Empire on the other as separate entities completely, because they have nothing in relationship with each other at all. Neither historically, nor ethnically, nor religiously, nor from the point of view of their alphabet. And they wage war against each other furiously over the years. The Croats loathe the Serbs, and the Serbs loathe the Croats. Anyway, When Bailey got back, he saw Churchill twice. He saw Anthony Eden, and when he saw Anthony Eden, he asked him what he thought of the signal, and Anthony Eden said he'd never seen it. So it never got to him for some reason. Churchill, he saw him twice, and I saw Bailey shortly after he'd seen Churchill, so he told me this himself personally. This is not in writing anyway. I'm the only witness about this. He said to me, I saw Churchill twice. First time I went down to Chequers, and I was ushered into him about an hour and a half later than the appointment, and it was very late in the evening. He was sitting in an armchair. He'd obviously had too much whiskey, and I talked to him, and I told him, because, you see, Bill Bailey had lived all his life in Serbia, and he'd really felt what was happening in Serbia, and he'd appealed to SOE to get him out before, and SOE would never get him out, and eventually he walked out to the coast and got out and came back with the information direct. And he was horrified by this first meeting with Churchill, and went back very dispirited to his flat, but was surprised 3 days later to get a message from SOE headquarters in London saying the Prime Minister wants to see you again. So he went back. This time he saw him earlier in the evening, and there was quite a different character in the chair. And it went more or less like this. Oh, well, good evening, Bailey. I've been giving serious thought to the interesting discourse you gave me the other night. He said, I'm horrified at what's happening in Serbia. Now, there are one or two things I'm not quite clear about. You were talking about the situation on the 8th of September. Was that the same as it was on the 4th of August? Or were there slight differences? And it appeared that Churchill had swallowed every single thing. This comatose figure in the chair with the whiskey by his side had in fact registered all that Bailey had said to him. And Bailey was one of several who'd gone in one after the other, having an interview with Churchill that night. And there was no one there taking notes at all.